What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
Why do Catholics worship Mary?
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
Where is purgatory in the Bible?
What's stopping you?
I think the Pope has too much authority.
What's stopping you? You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey everybody, welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN. Delighted to have you with us. This program is for our non-Catholic listeners, viewers, brothers and sisters. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, we are here to answer that question today. Here's that phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also send us an email, and the address is ctc@ewtn.com. You can do that 24 hours a day. Pedro Quiles, our producer. Matt Gabinski is our phone screener. Ace McKay handling social media, which would include YouTube, Facebook. If you're watching on one of those platforms right now, put your question in the chat screen, if you would. Ace will get that to us here in the studio. Also, those of you watching us on TV today, you can send us an email. Again, the address, ctc@ewtn.com. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I'm doing great. How about you, my friend?
I'm doing decent, thank you.
Interesting question here from Brenda, who says, a Catholic friend thinks it's unfair that women can't be priests. How can I respond to him about why I disagree with that?
Well, I'm not sure why you disagree with it, right? But I mean, I can talk about my perspective.
Sure.
Which is, as a faithful son of the church, I adhere to the church teaching on this matter. So Christ, of course, called only male apostles, and they ordained only male successors. And there is, from the first level, just there's no divine revelation, and there's no history and tradition for anything other than male-only ordination. And a standard sort of tried and true method of theological interpretation in the Catholic tradition is that when there's something that has always been that way everywhere with no exceptions, it's a pretty good chance that that's infallibly taught in the ordinary magisterium, even if it's never been the subject of a particular, like, papal document.
Okay.
And so for the first 2,000 years of the church's history, the ordination of men only to the sacred priesthood is just the universal presupposition, right? And if that weren't good enough for you, in the 20th century, with the advent of the modern feminist movement, popes have specifically tackled this question and taught definitively that the priesthood is reserved for men only. So for Catholics, you just get it coming and going. I mean, there's no way around this thing. It's part of the Catholic dogmatic system, and so you accept it as part of divine revelation. So once you have divine revelation in place and it's a non-negotiable, then you go trying to figure out the intelligibility of the thing. So why is it that Christ set the church up this way? And what modern popes like John Paul II have said is that the priesthood, since the priest stands in relationship to the church as a father to a family, and as Christ stands in relationship to the church as a husband or bridegroom to the bride, that the priest takes on that identity like an icon with respect to the church, particularly in sacred liturgy. And so that the bridegroom icon, if you will, is peculiarly evidenced, manifest in the ordination of a man to that role that wouldn't be fulfilled by a woman. There are feminine archetypes in the church's identity too. The church is a mother. The church is a mother. I mean, the church collectively, when we have an image of that, is a feminine image. And there's a singular individual who also represents the church's maternity in an iconographic way, and that's the Blessed Virgin Mary. I don't need to tell you that she's an extremely important person, far more powerful than any individual priest in the history of the tradition. And so stepping into these roles and assuming these identities is a very powerful mode of sanctity that doesn't imply any imbalance in power or significance. And of course, it doesn't prevent women from exercising leadership and governance roles. And as all of us here at EWTN know, that could include things like founding the world's largest religious broadcaster.
There is that.
You know, and running under the benevolent iron hand of Mother Angelica, who started this place and, of course, did not hesitate to use her executive authority and make unilateral decisions. You know, I mean, like, she was an authority, big time, big time, you know. And she taught. She taught. She preached, as it were, you know, not in the liturgy, but, I mean, so many of the functions of a priest can, in fact, be done by women and sometimes done better. All right. It's not about power. It's not about teaching. It's not about competence.
Brenda, thanks so much for your question. It is called a communion here on EWTN. Some lines are ringing right now. You can add yours to the queue at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Here's a question now from Jim. How do you know you've had an experience with your guardian angel?
Oh, you don't.
You don't?
You don't know that. You don't know that. I mean, I'm not saying God couldn't make it known to you in some extraordinary way. I mean, obviously, if, you know, a great neon light appears in the sky flashing back and forth and it says, Jim, you've had an experience with your guardian angel. This is God talking. You might wake up, right? But most of us don't ever have those kinds of things. And so, you know, one of the things that faith does is it disposes you to interpret events in your life in a supernatural frame when it's perfectly possible to interpret the very same event in a natural frame. You could come up with some naturalistic explanation, but if you're a person who's oriented to the life of faith, you say, well, you know, maybe this is God working through this. Maybe this is a sign. Maybe this is, you know, a token of God's love or something like that. You know, maybe this wasn't a hallucination. And you know, you always check those intuitions out with a spiritual authority, but that's part of what faith means. It means you know, having a frame of reference on reality that you can't perfectly prove from naturalistic reason, but which nevertheless renders life meaningful and benevolent and maybe virtue striving and transcendent, that sort of thing.
As I look back on my own life, I'm certainly very grateful that my guardian angel was on the J-O-B, if you know what I mean.
Of course.
Because that's certainly the way. Thank you so much for that question. Again, if you'd like to send us an email for a future show, the address is ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. In a moment, we're going to get to Joe in San Jose, California. Elizabeth is in Fargo. Got a couple lines open right now. You can grab one at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Or if you wish, and especially if you're watching us on TV, send us an email, ctc@ewtn.com. Back in a moment with more Call to Communion. It is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Hey, you can be inspired to follow in the footsteps of the saints. You can subscribe right now to receive The Daily Saint, featuring a brief biography delivered to your email inbox every day. Start now. Let the intercession and witness of the saints draw you closer to God. Daily Saints, let their faith be your guide. It's available right now missions.ewtn.com/dailysaints. A little quicker on that, ewtn.com/dailysaint. And if you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. Here is Joe in San Jose, California, listening on Sirius XM, channel 130. Hello, Joe. What's on your mind today?
Hi. Love the show. I was listening to a pastor who said that if you do psychological drugs such as acid or ayahuasca or these new type of psychological things, and I was concerned because I did acid in high school. I was young and dumb, and I did it in college as well. And I heard a pastor say that once you do these type of things, you awaken your demon. So I'm concerned, what kind, did I awaken my demon? Do I need some kind of exorcism? What kind of power do demons have to attach to a person or to, invade their mind, their privacy, whatever, if you do these kind of type of drugs, is there some kind of consequence spiritually as far as demons being able to attack you or stay with you and make your life miserable?
Okay.
So let me talk broadly about drug use, not just psychedelic drugs, and what kind of long-term spiritual consequences people might face from recreational drug use. And, you know, the kinds of drugs that people tend to abuse are those that work neurologically by exciting the dopamine system in the brain. You know, that's the neurotransmitter that usually gets emitted in the presence of some sort of pleasurable activity, and it trains your habit-forming machinery to seek out that experience again. And people choose, I mean, lots of things can do that. Tennis playing can do that. Eating, you know, chocolate chip cookies can do that. But of course, drugs do it far more powerfully. They do it sometimes in a way that's just quite overwhelming to the consciousness, that, you know, no chocolate cookie could ever hope to compete, you know, with the level of excitement that's generated in the brain through these kinds of drugs. And typically people take psychedelic drugs, or they take other recreational drugs, because they don't like the way they feel. They don't like their experiences in life. They're sad, they're depressed, they're bored, and they want to feel different. And drugs are very effective at making you feel different very quickly. And when people begin to use drugs, they just focus in on the pleasure, and they don't realize the damage that they're doing themselves. But here's a damage that takes a long time for people to realize, if they ever realize it. When you encounter hardships and difficulties, including boredom or depression or, you know, other psychological problems, the way out of that is to develop tools of resilience, right? So you learn how to cope with difficulty, with pain, with trauma. You develop hobbies. You find other forms of self-transcendence where you grow in virtue. You make new friends. You do all these kinds of things, and you sort of build a reservoir of experience and of maturity that can lift you out of the morass of depression, of anxiety, or whatever it might be. And when you use drugs, they take away the pain temporarily, and make it unnecessary. They sort of obviate the requirement to seek these forms of resilience. And so you become dependent on the change of consciousness that the drug induces. And unbeknownst to you, because you're not developing this greater maturity intellectually and socially and emotionally, you're blunting your emotional growth. You have delayed emotional growth. And so you remain infantile in your personality. And then, you know, maybe you start this when you're 13, 14 years old, and then one day you're 25 years old, but you still have the emotional maturity of a blunted 12-year-old, and you're totally incapable of handling the demands of life. And then, of course, as the demands of life become all that more pressing, well, what do? Well, you double down on the drug use, and it creates this negative spiral where you know, life starts closing in on you, and you retreat more and more and more into the drugs to cope with the demands of life that are now quite unbearable, and then you spiral down into nothingness, and it ends inevitably in jails, institutions, or death, or you find a new way to live, right? So that's the dynamic with drug use. It is very, very, very pernicious. That absolutely has spiritual consequences. And the spirituality in the Catholic tradition is about developing your personality after the pattern of Jesus, which means principally, among other things, but principally, learning how to accept suffering from the hand of a good God, recognizing that providence has some purpose in the trauma that you're going through, and learning how to identify it with Jesus. Well, if you're busy getting high because you don't want to deal with trauma, or you don't want to deal with discomfort, you're not spending the time you ought to be spending cultivating your personality in Jesus. So before we even bring in the question of the demonic, it's having profound spiritual consequences on you just at the level of bare neurology. Okay? Now, in addition to that, drug use sometimes, often, actually in American history, particularly when the movement got started in the 60s, the psychedelic movement, gets associated with ideological positions that are deeply contrary to the Christian faith, right? I don't know how old you are, if the name of Timothy Leary means anything to you, But Leary started an organization called, isn't this clever, the League for Spiritual Discovery, LSD. Ha, ha, ha. Isn't funny. That funny, right?
Yeah.
That advocated for drug use as a kind of quasi-sacrament, and he made all kinds of promises to people about personal enlightenment and spiritual growth. And, you know, someone who was very sympathetic to the spiritual aims of the 60s, but not to its psychedelic component, is the cultural critic Camille Paglia, who's no Catholic by any stretch of the imagination. But she said, you know, all the promising spiritual aspirations of her generation were destroyed through psychedelic drug use because the most promising minds rendered themselves imbecilic because they basically toasted their brains. So she saw that as a great kind of tragedy. Oddly enough, I once saw an interview with Bill Kreutzmann, one of the two drummers of the Grateful Dead, who was asked in this interview, what would you do differently? And he said, I wouldn't have done the drugs. Unbelievable admission, right?
Wow.
From like, you know, the heart of the psychedelic pop culture movement, saying, you know, when we were on that stuff, we couldn't listen to each other as musicians. Like, you know, I played better when I wasn't high, basically, you know. So it did. It destroyed the spiritual aspirations. And you know, the ideology infected by the chemical enhancement further deepens the the spiritual damage. Now, one of the interpretations of demonic influence that St. Paul offers, particularly in the book of Colossians, when he talks about the elemental spiritual forces of this world with which we do battle, are precisely demonic ideologies, like the ideology around psychedelic drug use that arose in the 1960s. You know, do I think that you need an exorcism? No. You haven't given me any reason to think that you need an exorcism. I mean, you're not floating 6 inches off the floor and, like, spouting blasphemies against Jesus, are you? That would be a clue, or speaking in unknown languages that you didn't pick up in order to utter curses. I mean, you're not doing the sort of standard demon-possessed sorts of things. But, you know, if this was a part of your life, you just have to be aware of the fact that, you know, once you lay down a habit pattern in your neurology, it doesn't go away. You can build a new one on top of it. But, you know, former drug users and abusers of alcohol or whatever the addiction was know that they can be sober for 20 years, but if they indulge just one time, they don't go back to the beginning of their addiction. They go back to the last point they left off at the end of their addiction. Like, you've put yourself in a kind of danger.
Mm-hmm.
Can the devil take advantage of that? You bet. But I don't see any reason to think that you have some, you know, malevolent demon hanging on your shoulder right now as a specific result of the drug use, unless you give me particular evidences of that fact.
Sure. Hey, thanks so much for your phone call. That opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, 833-288-3986. It is Call to Communion here on EWTN. Let's go now to Donald in Connecticut. Hey, Donald, what's on your mind today?
Hi there, Dave. This is Donald.
Yeah, go right ahead.
Yeah, this is Donald from Rocky Hill, Connecticut. I have two questions for you. But first, I want to thank you for your show. I've been watching your show for so many years that I feel like you're a member of my family. And it's a pleasure to talk with you personally today.
Thank you.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Thank you very much for that, Donald.
Okay. I come from a strong Catholic background, but I was raised Methodist. And with the help of EWTM, I'm getting back to my Catholic roots. Anyway, my first question. I'm a member of a so-called ARM, Alternative Religious Movement. And my movement teaches that the Blessed Mother Mary was a failure. She was a failure because she didn't raise Jesus properly, and she failed to protect Jesus as he was growing up. Also, she was a failure because she had two sons and a daughter that we know from the Bible, or probably more, from her husband Joseph. Dave, how would you respond to that?
Yeah, thanks. So I'm assuming that we're probably talking here about the Unification Church, what some people call the Moonies, because it was founded by Sun Myung Moon. And my understanding of this theology is that it is in the service of promoting the alleged messiahship of Sun Myung Moon and the role of his wife, Hak Jae Hon Moon. And so I don't think this is a doctrine that has any scriptural warrant. I don't think it has any historical warrant. I think it is an ad hoc invention by a pretender who wanted to enhance his own claims to messianic authority. And, you know, it's interesting. It's a point of strong contrast to Jesus, who kind of went out of his way not to proclaim his messianic authority and told people to shut up and not talk about it. And whenever people would say, you know, you're the Messiah, he would go, shush, don't tell anyone, you know. And in Christ's, you know, Christ was not about self-promotion at all, right? Clearly not on the world stage. He was about, you know, he said the Son of Man came not to serve, but to be served, excuse me, not to be served, but to serve.
Right, right.
And to give his life as a ransom for many. And he, in fact, lived that way. So, yeah, I would, of course, I would reject that that doctrine of the Unification Church. It's clearly not Catholic. It's not biblical. It's not traditional. It's not historical. And I would understand that as a kind of, convenient conceit invented by someone who wanted to enhance their own authority.
Donald, thank you so much for your call and for your kind words about the show. It is Call to Communion here on EWTN. Got a call here from Elizabeth in Fargo. She couldn't stay on the line, but she did leave us with this question. In the renewal of baptismal promises, why do they omit that Jesus was conceived by the Holy Spirit?
That is a darn good question, and I don't know the answer. I'd have to go pull the renewal promises again and reread them to refresh my memory. But, I think that, you know, the gist of the renewal idea is that I'm committing my life to submit to Jesus, the Lord and the King, and I'm rejecting the forces of evil. And I guess they highlight those aspects, I mean, Christ's kingship, Christ's authority, Christ's lordship over my life, and my own determination to turn away from sin and the devil and his evil ways.
Okay. Appreciate that. Elizabeth, thanks for calling in from Fargo. Here's a quick question from Matthew, also watching us on YouTube today. Does the church officially teach that Moses is the author of the Pentateuch? Recent theories suggest other authorship. Should Catholics be concerned about authorship or focus on divine inspiration?
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So the traditional teaching is that Moses is the author of the Pentateuch. The problem is that it's not recent scholarship. The scholarship's, 200 years old, but there's a significant body of scholarship on the Old Testament that strongly suggests that the Pentateuch is a composite work that was edited and put together over time by multiple authors. There are strands of Hebrew that can be detected and we can confirm archaeologically come from very different strata of Israelite society. And as well as literary evidence that this is not a composite work. I mean, this is not a work of a single author. It's a composite work by multiple authors or editors, and so some version of the documentary hypothesis is now just de rigueur among biblical scholars, including Catholic biblical scholars, and it seems to be a presupposition in at least some magisterial teaching. So when you read John Paul II's Theology of the Body, for example, he without hesitation or shame, he will reference, say, the Yahwist author of the Pentateuch and distinguish that from other strands within the Pentateuchal tradition. Joseph Ratzinger does the same. And most of the recent magisterial and associated teaching, by associated, I mean things like from the Pontifical Biblical Commission, seem to presuppose strongly some of the major theses of higher criticism. As far as the question of divine inspiration is concerned and how that jives with higher critical theory, I strongly recommend you take a look at the 2014 document produced by the Pontifical Biblical Commission on the inspiration and truth of sacred scripture. And it goes into these questions in some depth and gives, if not the infallible answer, at least a highly authoritative one that was composed by the Pontifical Biblical Commission, consists of biblical scholars that have been nominated by bishops' conferences around the world that have the approbation of the Pope. So it's scholarly opinion, but of a very high order.
And just to clear things up, the Pentateuch is what?
Oh, the first five books of the Bible, Book
thank
of Moses.
You.
Yeah, thank you.
Hey, you never know.
You're right.
Some folks may not be aware of that. In a moment, we're going to talk with Douglas in Omaha, Charles in New Iberia, Louisiana. Lots more straight ahead on Call to Communion with Dr. David Andrews. Stay with us. Still time for your phone call to EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Andrews. That line is 833- 888-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. 3986. Hey, congratulations to another EWTN radio partner, the great Billings Catholic Radio, with three stations serving Billings and Laurel, Montana, celebrating 15 years with us. How about that? Congratulations to Deacon Roy Brown and his great team there at Billings Catholic Radio from your friends here at EWTN. All right, back to the phones now at 833-288-EWTN. Here is Douglas in Omaha, where you were over the weekend.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The great Spirit Catholic Radio is where he's listening. Douglas, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, so I had a woman, a friend of mine asked me a question. She was asked, wondering whether abortion or homosexuality was more evil. I told her I think abortion is, because that's a killing of the innocent, than homosexuality. And I just want to know if that was correct.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate the question. So, you know, the church doesn't give us a ranking of sins and virtues and say, you know, if you're going to go down the list of sins, make sure you pick one that's lower on the list. You know, that's not the way the church operates, you know.
This is not the American top 40.
This is not American top 40, you know, exactly. And so, I think the question is intelligible and there's an intelligible answer to it. Like, you know, I don't think in terms of practically, I don't know this has a whole lot of input into the way we live our lives. I mean, you know, it might have some input in the way, you know, a priest might select his homilies and think what evils does he want to focus on, you know, but you know, sin is sin and you want to avoid it wherever it can be found, right? Now, all sin involves a kind of deformation or a kind of insult to the dignity of the human person. And so you definitely can think about rank ordering them in the degree of harm that you cause to a person. It's probably not a good idea to expose a person who's deeply allergic to secondhand smoke in a restaurant.
Yeah.
Okay? That's obviously not nearly as bad as physical assault. I mean, it just stands to reason, right? You know, the church's teaching on homosexual relations is that they're against nature. They're against the nature of the human person, and they don't tend to human flourishing in the most robust sense. But when you've killed somebody, like, you've taken the question of human flourishing off the table. There's no more flourishing to be done. So murder really is kind of the chief among sins, right? Because it's the complete destruction, the wanton destruction of a human being. Everything else, you know, that leaves the question of life open, you at least have the possibility of some kind of recovery. Mm-hmm. Hope, you know, maybe in practice, maybe never, but some kind of recovery, some kind of restitution, some kind of improvement coming back from the brink. But once you've killed them, they're out of the picture. So that really is the worst.
Douglas, thanks for checking in from Omaha. Here is Charles now in New Iberia, Louisiana, listening on Christ Our King Radio. Hello there, Charles. What's on your mind today?
Hello.
Hi, Charles.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go right ahead, Charles.
Great. Anders, such a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
I've been a fan of the show for a few years.
Thank you so much.
I'm a recent Catholic convert, and your show has been one part of that. I was just asking a question about the Catholic position about prayers not being more... Or maybe it's not about prayers not being meritorious if you're not in a state of grace.
Sure.
And I have heard you say on your show that no prayer is wasted. So I was wondering if you could just say something about that.
So first of all, it's Jesus' teaching, it's not mine, that there is prayer that is not meritorious. Christ teaches in the gospel. He says, when you pray... Do not pray on street corners to be seen by men. If you do that, I tell you truly, you have received your reward in full. Rather, pray in secret, and your Father in heaven who sees you in secret will reward you. But obviously the reward he's talking about here is the reward of an increase in grace and of eternal life, right? And so the whole tradition is predicated on the idea that there are prayers that don't work. There are prayers that are not helpful, that are, in fact, prayers that are sinful. John of the Cross said some people pray quite badly and think they pray well. Some people pray well and think they pray badly. It's one of the reasons you need spiritual direction. It's because sometimes we're not good judges of, you know, how we're doing, right? So that's definitely a concept. Now, to say that no prayer is ever wasted, so maybe I should qualify that. You know, if I am praying literally to impose my will upon another person, to be self-aggrandizing, to show off, that's not going to bear any positive spiritual fruit in me, right? No. I mean, maybe I'll serve as an example of, like, what not to do. I mean, that would be the only positive benefit that I could see, right? But there are other contexts where prayer that's not offered in the state of grace can clearly be helpful, even if it's not meritorious. Principally, the prayer of repentance. When I come to my senses and realize I'm going the wrong way, I need to get straight with God. Dear Lord, please have mercy on me, a sinner. Well, I'm not saying, dear Lord, please have mercy on me, a righteous dude in the state of grace. I'm saying, dear God, please have mercy on me, a sinner. Like, I'm conscious that I'm not on the right path. Mm-hmm. Well, God answers that prayer. He answers that prayer with a gift of grace and forgiveness. So that's very efficacious. Now, you know, in the mystery of salvation, we also have to throw open the possibility that a person may pray on behalf of someone else, that for some reason God might answer that prayer for reasons of his own providential design that we know nothing of, mm-hmm. whether or not the one offering the prayer is in the state of grace. But clearly, the ideal is to be praying in the state of grace so that we're praying in accord with the will of God. If you want your prayers answered, it's a pretty good bet that if you're asking what God wants to give you already, then you're pretty likely to get what you ask for. If you ask for something that God doesn't want to give you, you're probably not going to get it. So the solution is align your will with the will of God. The more you do that, the more infallibly your prayers will be answered. So finally, the one prayer that you know God will always answer in the affirmative is, thy will be done. It's going to be done whether you want it to or not.
Yeah.
So you might as well get on board.
So the key there, I think, is to pray thy will be done and mean it.
And mean it.
Yeah. Not just walk through
it. And try to integrate that into your conception of yourself and your life.
Beautiful. Charles, thanks for checking in from Louisiana. We appreciate hearing from you today on EWTN's Call to Communion. Still time for a few more phone calls here at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Rick is a first-time caller from Maryland, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Hello, Rick. What's on your mind today?
Yeah, hi. You can hear me okay?
Yeah, go right ahead, Rick.
All righty. So I'm asking this question with the utmost, you know, respect to all Catholics. I was raised Catholic. I respect the Catholic faith, and you know, I even go to confession, even though I don't attend Mass regularly. I'm actually a born again Baptist. Okay, but one of the things that I've had that basically has somewhat prohibited me from really embracing the Catholic faith is that priests are not allowed to marry, even though historically they were for about 1,000 years. And there is a distinction, I understand it was explained to me, between priests marrying and married men becoming priests. I can understand that. But it just seems arbitrary to me to not allow priests to have family. And it just, to me, it opens up an entire can of worms for, you know, you were talking about Satan before, about potentially Satan coming in and making use of that, I guess, that distinction within the Catholic Church. And I just want to say, like, you know, Peter was married, Abraham was married. I personally believe that priests ought to be able to be married, and that could avoid all of the controversy that we've seen in the Catholic Church over the last, you know, several decades.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So I'm going to agree with some of the things that you said. I'm going to take issue with a few things that you said. I'm going to qualify a few things. First of all, there is absolutely no doubt in my mind that priestly celibacy is not the reason, but it is a factor in understanding the way in which clerical abuse has unfolded throughout history, perhaps, and also in the 20th century, because by cloaking the priest in an aura and a mystique of sanctity, it gave the church a kind of plausible deniability. And one of the things that was so scandalous about the priestly abuse situation is the way the church swept the thing under the rug, really, not the church, but like individual bishops, particularly in Boston, that's kind of the ground zero for this thing, swept the thing under the rug and used the culture of clericalism, which is enforced and reinforced by the clerical celibacy, as a way of hiding that sort of stuff. So when you want to talk about, well, this is fomented scandal in the church, to that extent, I agree with you. I do not think the fact of being an unmarried man in any way necessitates the abuse of children. And there are lots of successfully celibate people, ordained and not ordained.
Yep.
Right? Lots of lay people who are not married, who do not abuse kids and who live chaste lives. There are also many married people who do not lead chaste lives, right? Look at some of the statistics on, well, just read the statistics on whether it's adultery or pornography use or what have you across demographics, and you'll find that marriage is not a protector against sexual misconduct. Nor does it inoculate clergy against this problem. I think you mentioned that you're in a Baptist tradition. I assume you're aware of what the revelations are about the Southern Baptist Church and their own record of covering up clerical sexual abuse within their own denomination. It's quite extensive. And what we now realize, if you dig far enough beneath the surface, you find this kind of behavior in almost every domain, whether it's ecclesiastical or whether it's secular. Some of the researchers that have looked into this sort of dynamic in public school systems have found that the sheer scale of the problem in public schools historically has been immense. In my own life, I went to a secular, non-Christian private high school that had nothing Catholic or ecclesial in its identity at all. And there was an internal investigation within the last 10 years that uncovered that there were multiple instances of inappropriate faculty contact with students, and in all but one of the cases, all the perpetrators were married men.
Ugh.
Right? And I actually had some firsthand knowledge of that, not because anybody did anything to me, but I had a couple of these characters make advances that I rebuffed, right? And at the time, I'm being like 17 years old, I had no context for that. I had no category for it. I didn't really register it as a kind of abuse or corruption activity until I became a grown man and actually went through youth protection classes. And I went, oh my gosh, that happened to me. Somebody tried to do that to me. And I kind of clicked, you know, and then turns out those were the very same characters that ended up, you know, losing their position years later. So this is not a problem that's unique to Catholicism, and I don't necessarily think that marriage helps it. I do think there's the context I spelled out that is a contributing factor to the way the church covered it up, and people being able to hide behind the veneer of celibacy and chastity to give themselves an aura of sanctity that enabled them to become more effective abusers. But I don't think it's the fault of celibacy per se. Not being married does not predispose you to sex abuse. Having certain kind of psychological deficits, having certain kind of emotional immaturity, those things dispose you to sexual abuse. If the Catholic Church has a problem, it's not, in my judgment, in the fact that its priests are unmarried. It has more to do in things like the culture of clericalism and the types of criteria that are used for recruiting priests and not sufficient attention to those, you know, deep, more inner qualifications. Mm-hmm. That's where the problem lies, okay, in my judgment. And as you know, I'm sure you do know this, the Catholic Church, in fact, does have married Catholic priests.
Yes.
Does, in fact, have them. Mm-hmm. And not just in the Eastern Rites. We have lots of them in the Eastern Rites. We have them in the Latin Rite, too. I know these guys. I mean, I know some of them personally, right? And they have wives and they have children and they function and people, you know, receive their ministries and it's not a problem. Okay. Now, you also made the charge that the restriction was arbitrary. That it was arbitrary. It's not arbitrary. It's not arbitrary at all. And I'm going to give you some reasons why it's not arbitrary. Do you think it was arbitrary that Jesus Christ didn't have a wife? I mean, is that just an accident? Jesus, he was just a lousy date? You know, I mean, he got rebuffed in high school and he decided he'd give up on women? No. I mean, it's central to his vocation. I have come not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me. His bride is the church. If Christ had had a human wife, it would have totally changed the iconic character of his human ministry and human life. And so the priest's desire to visibly represent Christ to other people and to be in the world as Christ was in the world. St. Paul talks about this. The married man is worried about the affairs of his wife. The unmarried man can give himself entirely to the work of the church, right? That's not arbitrary. That is very principled. Now, in my own life, in my relationship to priests, I can tell you, I have known some men and I have who are priests of whom I thought they should have married. They made a mistake. The church would be better off without their ministry. Some of those guys end up getting laicized, right? Kicked out of the priesthood because they can't live the vocation of celibacy. Well, but every single priest that has touched my life in a deeply positive way in that of my family, their ministry to me and my family is not accidental to their celibate vocation. Their celibate vocation has been absolutely integral to it. And you have to be in relationship to a celibate priest, and particularly to religious priests who take vows of poverty and chastity and as well as obedience, to understand just how this contributes to the way they can be in the world and be of service to others. You know, I have married friends that I love dearly that want to spend time with me and I want to spend time with them. And you know what? We can't because we have family duties. And so we communicate by phone and email and other ways. And once in a blue moon, we get to have lunch together, right? But there are priests in my life who have been able to be there at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, at the drop of a hat and have made themselves available to people by way of service in a way that they would fundamentally not be able to if they were married, right? And so it's not arbitrary at all.
Appreciate your phone call. It is Call to Communion here on EWTN. We're big believers about the rosary, as you probably know, and EWTN for many, many years has brought you the Holy Rosary twice each day, and if you want to be specific about it, for over 30 years. So tune in every morning at 5:30 Eastern for Mother Angelica leading us in the rosary, and every evening at 9:30 p.m. Eastern for Father Benedict Groeschel leading us in the rosary only on EWTN Radio. Let's go now to Gerald in Minnesota, listening to us on YouTube today. Hello, Gerald. What's on your mind today?
Hey, guys. Yeah, it's Gerard, but it's all good.
I beg your pardon. What's on your mind today, Gerard?
Hey, thank you. Thank you, Tom, and thank you, David. You guys are tremendous. Hey, I just had a quick question on religious submission of intellect and will to the ordinary magisterium, especially the papal magisterium.
Yeah.
So when it comes to things like the death penalty, for instance, which is a part of the authentic magisterium, how can the laity, or what should the laity do when they have like an interior struggle with giving that submission? Are they allowed to withhold consent in any kind of way? And
yes.
How does that look? Like, what can we do online? Can we voice our public opinion constructively, et cetera, et cetera?
Okay.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate the question. So I'm going to give you some principles, but I'm going to direct you to a source that goes into this in much greater depth. There is a document from the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. It was produced by Cardinal Ratzinger, and it's called a Doctrinal Commentary on the Concluding Formula of the Professio Fidei. Doctrinal Commentary on the Professio Fidei. And it goes into all the levels of Catholic teaching and their respective authority and the kind of assent or deference that is owed to each one and when and under what conditions a person might actually dissent. There's also a much more detailed discussion of this question in a document called Donum Veritatis on the Ecclesial Vocation of the Theologian that has an extended discussion on legitimate theological dissent. All right, so you may find both of those documents very helpful. But, you know, the basic attitude is that when the magisterium declares something to be a dogma, what they're saying is this is contained in the data of revelation. It's been handed to us by God. And therefore, it requires the assent of faith, right? So that's a relatively small number of propositions. All right. Then there are those things that are understood to be sort of direct logical entailments of dogmas of what's divinely revealed. And while one does not hold those entailments as themselves divinely revealed, one holds them with the same degree of conviction, the same sort of indissoluble commitment that one would hold to a dogma, even though the nature of the content of that assent is a little bit different. But the non-revocable character is the same, right? Then there are those teachings that lack that relationship to dogmatic truth, where one offers a religious submission of mind and will, and that doesn't mean that one believes it with the theological virtue of faith. At a very basic level, when the magisterial authority in my life, which could just be my pastor, stands up and makes a pronouncement in church, and I may think that it is very badly formulated, or perhaps it even erroneous in some way, the first thing that I do is I don't stand up in the parish during Mass and yell, "That's wrong! Let me give you a better explanation," you know, because that's not my role, right? And I recognize the right of the teaching authority to pronounce on this issue, even at the risk of maybe not formulating in the best way. So, say, for example, I find the line of reasoning, the deductive logic behind a prudential judgment like this, to be invalid, like there's a flaw here in the way this thing is argued, that's a perfectly legitimate conclusion to hold, right? And to raise questions about it. When it comes to the death penalty specifically, the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith concluded that withholding assent from the ordinary magisterial teaching on the illegitimacy of the death penalty is not an issue that separates one from Catholic communion. They've said that's not an issue. This is not a question of being a heretic, okay. Right? But I would say, like I said about the pastor preaching something you don't agree with, I'm not going to get on Catholic radio and take on the church's position on the death penalty. I'm not going to give you my personal beliefs on this, but let's say I strongly dissented. Like, that's not my role. You know, my role is not to give out my own personal opinion.
Right.
Now, you know, we can have an extended discussion about it and reason through it. Mm-hmm. And I can, we can respect the position that somebody might take. But, I mean, this is the church's policy position, right? And so, it's like if you work for the Republican National Committee, you're not going to try to publicly undercut the platform that party publishes. You might not personally hold to every one of the principles that they've enumerated, but your job as part of the machinery is to promote the platform. You know, you're not going to undercut the platform.
Right.
And I'm not going to sit there and try to undercut the church's political platform or its policy platform or its moral framework or whatever that's articulated. Now, I'd like to offer, I will offer a personal reflection on the death penalty. I understand the reasons that this teaching is held to be problematic by some people, particularly in light of the history of the tradition on this issue, given that the church has so consistently down through the era approved the use of the death penalty, and now in the late 20th century they seem to backtrack on that position. I mean, into the 1960s, the church had the death penalty on its own books in Vatican City and employed a Vatican executioner. Right. So if you just come out and say this is just categorically wrong, well, you really put the church in a deuce of a position. So I understand that. I get all that. But for me, a very pragmatic issue, and this is not like deeply theoretical, it's just pragmatic. If, in fact, the church came out and were vocally proposing or a strong proponent publicly of the death penalty, the level of, international policy, I ask myself the question, who would be hurt and who would benefit? And I think that the people who would most benefit are the most tyrannical regimes that tend to use the death penalty in the most flagrant and unjust way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're not going to move secular France to somehow go back and reinstitute the death penalty.
No.
But there are other regimes in the world that would double down and go, woohoo, okay, let's round us up some more political prisoners and off with their head,
Well, we thank you so much, Gerard, for your phone call today from Minnesota. Couldn't get to Jane, a first-time caller from Massachusetts. Jane, please call us back tomorrow. We'll put you at the head of the line. We also received a whole bunch of YouTube questions that we just flat ran out of time for, but we're going to do those probably on tomorrow's program or sometime later this week. Hey, Dr. David Anders, thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
We do it right here on EWTN, on the radio side of EWTN, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, Monday through Friday. Check out the recording of today's show. Go to EWTN.com/listen. On behalf of our great team here, I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders. Thank you so much for joining us. See you next time here on EWTN's Call to Communion. God bless.